Part 5, Chapter 3. Collecting things that would aid his escape was not easy. At first, Johnny had thought he might handle the two button cameras that overlooked his cage, one inside and one outside. If he could bypass these, then at night he could open his collar and freely get about and prepare. He had spent valuable time studying button cameras in the electronics shop. They were simple devices. They had a small mirror to catch the image, and the image became transmitted electrons. The pattern was simply picked up and recorded on a disc. There was no power in the button camera. Power was transmitted to it on a closed circuit from the receiver. He tried to modify his instruction machine to perform the same function. His object was to record a view of the cage with him in it. Then, with a quick switchover, he could leave the button cameras transmitting that picture while he himself was elsewhere. But there were two cameras, viewing from different angles. He only had one recorder. Turl caught him one day with the instruction machine in pieces. He was bringing in a rabbit he had shot. The monster stood there for a while and finally said,
"Teach an animal a trick and it has to work it on everything. I think you've wrecked that playing machine."
Johnny went on reassembling it.
"Put it back together so it works and you can have this rabbit."
Johnny ignored him. But when he had the machine back together, Turl threw down the rabbit.
"Don't monkey with things that don't need fixing,"
Turl said with the air of, "Good God, what you have to teach an animal." But later, Johnny got a break. The problem was body heat detection equipment. If in some way he could nullify such surveillance, then he hoped he could get to the mountains. He doubted he could be traced if the heat-seeking equipment could be fooled. Kerr had him running a drill into the side of a mine shaft over at the actual mine. It was an abandoned hole, about 50 feet in diameter. Kerr had lowered the drill platform down into the hole. At that point, a rock outcropping was exposed. Under the platform was an ore net. The drill was heavy, having been built for cyclos. Johnny's muscles bulged as he bucked the bit into the outcropping. He had a phone in his ear, and Kerr was chattering away into it.
"Don't push steady. Just lean on it and let up, time after time. After you got a hole drilled, trip the second trigger, and the drill will expand and break off the ore. Keep the net in place to catch it as it falls. Now just keep that sequence going."
"It's hot!"
Johnny had yelled back up at him. And it was hot. The drill, spinning at high revs, was heating the wall and in itself was almost glowing with friction.
"Oh, you haven't got a heat protector."
He fished around in his pockets amid papers and bits of old snacks and finally dug out a very small package. He put it in a lowering cup and let it down on a line. Johnny opened it up. It was a sheet of thin, transparent stuff. It had two sleeves.
"Put it on!"
yelled Kerr. Johnny was amazed that so much area could be compressed into such a small package. The garment was built for a cyclo, and the sleeves were enormous, and it was much too long. He took some tucks in it and put it on over his head and down the front of his body. He resumed bucking the drill. It was amazing. The reflected heat from the wall and the drill bit did not reach him. After Kerr finally decided Johnny could use the drill and handle the rig, and Johnny was back on level ground, he went through the motions of giving back the heat shield.
"No, no. Throw it away. It's disposable. They get dirty and torn. A driller usually carries half a dozen. I don't know why I forgot, but I ain't been a driller for years."
"It's the only one I got," said Johnny.
"And you're sure a driller?"
Johnny neatly repackaged it and put it in his pouch. He was betting that no heat detector could detect through it. If he wore it and kept it from gaping, the spinning scanner would be blind to it. He hoped. The food problem he had solved. The smoked beef was compact and would keep him from starving if he was running so fast that he had no time to hunt. He carefully patched up moccasins and made sure he had an extra pair. Turl observed that, too.
"You don't have to wear those, you know,"
Turl said one evening as he came out to check the cage locks.
"They're old chinko boots that could be cut down." Didn't they give you any boots with your clothes?
The following day, the compound tailor came out, complaining in his breathe mask, and measured Johnny for boots.
I am not a bootmaker,
he protested. But Turl had shown him the blanket requisition, so the tailor also measured Johnny for a heavy knee-length overcoat and cold-weather cap.
It is coming on to summer,
said the tailor.
It's not the time of year for winter clothing.
But he had done the measuring anyway, and very soon the boots and clothing were delivered to the cage.
Freaky executives,
the tailor had muttered during the final try-on.
Dressing up animals!
It made Johnny uneasy that Turl was being obliging. He carefully checked all his preparations over to see whether any could give away his plans to escape. He decided not. Turl seemed very preoccupied these days, indifferent. Or was that a pose? The thing that was really giving Johnny a problem was how to get his hands on a gun. Before all the mutiny precautions, some of the workers he had seen had worn relatively small, compact handguns at their belts. He had supposed they used them for plinking or shooting game. Turl still wore his, a rather bigger one, but the others seemed to have stopped. Johnny wondered how far he could trust Kerr. The midget was definitely Turl's creature, but from some of the tales Kerr had chattered on with, he was distinctly criminal. He told how he had rigged certain games of chance, how he had looted ore boxes as a joke, how he had gotten a female to believe her father needed money and relayed it for her. One day, they were waiting for a machine to be idle so it could be used in practice, and Johnny decided to make a test. He still had the two discs he had gotten in the Great Village. He knew now that one was a silvery coin and the other a gold coin. He took the silver coin out of his pocket and began flipping it.
What's that?
Kerr wanted to know. Johnny gave it to him, and Kerr scratched it with a talon.
I dug some of these up once in a wrecked town on the southern continent. You must have gotten this locally, though.
Why?
Said Johnny, alert that perhaps Kerr could read English letters.
It's fake. An alloy of copper with a nickel-silver plating. A real coin, and I saw some once, is solid silver.
He handed it back, losing interest. Johnny took out the yellow coin and started flipping it. Kerr caught it in the air before it could fall back into Johnny's hand. His interest was sudden and intense.
Hey, where'd you get this?
Kerr dented the edge with a talon tip and looked at it closely.
Why?
Said Johnny, innocently.
Is it worth something?
A very sly look came into Kerr's eye. The coin he was holding and trying to be casual about was worth 4,000 credits. Gold, alloyed just enough to be used in coinage without undue wear. Kerr steadied his hand and looked very, very casual.
Where'd you get this?
Well, it came from a very dangerous place.
There are more of them?
Kerr was quivering a little bit. He was holding in his paw 3 months' pay, all in one little coin. And as an employee, he could legally possess it as a souvenir. On Cyclo, it could buy a wife. He tried to remember how many coins it took for them to cease to be souvenirs and become company property. 10? 13? So long as they were old and obviously mintage, not some fake made by a miner.
The place is so dangerous, one couldn't go there without at least a belt gun.
Kerr looked at him searchingly.
Are you trying to get me to give you a belt gun?
Would I do something like that?
Yes.
This animal was very, very quick on machines. Quicker, in fact, than Cyclo trainees. Kerr looked longingly at the gold coin or medallion or whatever it had been. He said nothing. Then he handed it back to Johnny and just sat there, his amber eyes shadowed in the depths of his breathe gas dome. Johnny took the coin back.
I'm careless with things like this. I can't buy anything, you know. I keep it in a hole just to the right of the cage door as you come in.
Kerr sat there for a while. Then he said,
"The next machine is ready."
But that night, while Turl was making his rounds of the mine site and was distant from his viewing screen, the gold coin disappeared from the hole where Johnny had put it. And in the morning, when Johnny dug there, covering the action with his body, a small handgun and spare charges were in the hole instead. Johnny had a gun.